Hello everyone, welcome to today's show. Today's show is going to be about human factors and ergonomics, the fundamentals of those two things. And we're very privileged to have Bob Bridger on the show today. So let's head to the intro and find out all about Bob before we welcome him in.
Bob is an ex-Ministry of Defence specialist author and has extensive experience in the maritime and healthcare domains. With significant experience over many years in office and industrial ergonomics, Bob is the author of a standard textbook on human factors and ergonomics which sells worldwide and is now in its fourth edition. After three successful years, Bob stepped down in April 2021 as the president of the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics and Human Factors. He's a trained expert witness, Academy of Experts, Gray's Inn 2005. Bob recently drafted a curriculum for a new MSc program in human factors and patient safety. Welcome to the show, Dr. Robert Bridger.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Hi, Natalie. I'm doing very well, thanks. Good. Welcome. And nice to say hello to everyone as well.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. We're so thankful to have you on the show today, Bob. You're such a big human factors guru, so it's a real privilege to actually get to speak to you. And as a master's student in human factors, yeah, it's a great moment for me to speak to you after referring to your book so many times in my assignments. So it's great to hear from you today, and I'm looking forward to what you're going to share with us about human factors. I'm anticipating that some people that will be tuning in today might not know a lot about human factors, or they might have heard about some smaller aspects of human factors, maybe experienced them in their workplaces, different assessments. We're going to start with a bit of an overview about what human factors is about and ergonomics, what's the difference. So can you share with us about that?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I always tell people in relation to human factors and its definition is that human factors is not about people. It really isn't. And it's easy, you know, for people who are not qualified or studied human factors as you and I have, it's easy to make that mistake. It's about working conditions, tools and equipment and work environments and how they affect people and how we can design them to get the best out of our systems. And I think that one of the key things about human factors is that it regards workers and people as part of the system. You know, they are the human component, the bit that makes the rest of the system work. And so what we want to do is we want to design things so that we integrate people with technologies, equipment in the most effective and productive way. And if by effective, I also mean equipment's usable and safe, working conditions appropriate to human capabilities and needs, and all of those kinds of things. So it's quite a broad discipline. And the other point to say, really, is that it's intrinsically multidisciplinary. So if you think about it, I sometimes try and locate it, you know, because we know about engineering and we know about medicine and we know about psychology. So where does human factors fit in? So I think if you imagine, you know, like a Venn diagram with circles, you've got an engineering circle, you've got a medicine, occupational health circle, and then you've got a sort of a psychology, social science circle. Human factors is the bit where they all overlap.
Yeah, that's so great. How you explained it around that it's actually not focused on the people, even though it's human factors. I think that's really interesting way to explain it, and I can really relate, because actually we're looking at the environment, the way we've set up work processes, equipment, like you said, and looking at how that influences how people do their work, how people's performance, productivity. That was a great way to explain it. I'm sure everybody really understood. So you explained about looking at into what we've set up, like designs. Do you have any examples around where designs have actually led to human errors that you could share?
I can actually. I can, in fact, tell you about a design that led me to make an error. I was in the supermarket one day. It's quite a long time ago, and it was summertime, and I wanted to buy a can of olives. And they had these huge cans of olives with 3 kilograms in them. And it was a Saturday morning, so as you might imagine, I wasn't perhaps at my best. Not as perhaps alert and as bright as I would have been on a Monday morning. And I walked down the aisle, and I came to the olive section, and there was this enormous can of olives, 3 kilograms of olives. And on the label, there was a wonderful picture of a sort of historical picture of a Greek countryman in traditional clothing next to an olive tree. And this very enticing and inviting visual image caught my attention. And the olives on the olive tree were black olives. And because I like black olives, I don't like green olives very much, I bought it. And when I got it home and opened it, I found it contained green olives. I was a bit surprised, actually. And when I looked at the label and actually read it, it said in large black letters on the tin, green olives. Now, that's a good example where a piece of design has caused someone, in this case me, to make an error, which had consequences because I had to get through 3 kilograms of green olives. It actually illustrates some very good basic ergonomic principles, which is compatibility. You know, when you display information to people, the way you use colours, the way you use images and words, they must be compatible to get a coherent message across. And this leads us into something that's perhaps some of your readers may or listeners may have heard about, which is the distinction between what's called System 1 and System 2. Have you heard of Daniel Kahneman's book and all that kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah. How, you know, we live our lives on automatic pilot most of the time. System 1 is where it's the system that is effortless. Things go on automatically. We process information around us and react to it appropriately without having to think too much or think at all, really. Like when you're driving your car and you see the red traffic light, you slow down. You don't have to interpret the red traffic light. You just know what to do. So you're operating under System 1. System 2 is where we have to make decisions. We have to process information consciously. And System 2 is effortful. It's like deciding, you know, solving a mathematical problem, for example. Solving a problem in stats. You know, if you can remember when you were at university doing your stats classes, you know, System 2 heavily engaged there. Probably through that Excel file to find out where you made the error. No, I'm sure you didn't, but you get what I mean.
Yeah. So
going back to the olives example, when we're looking for things in the supermarket, we are very much processing using System 1. We don't necessarily read the labels on all of the tins and packets of food that we buy, do we?
No.
We don't. So that's how it's important. The substantive piece of information there the substantive piece of information on the tins is the visual image, particularly if it's something that we're used to and we've seen before, and it concurs with what we want to achieve. So that's just an example of how a simple example of how a work environment causes someone to make an error.
Yeah, and I think part of that different types of thinking where we're often operating in the automatic thinking is to conserve energy, isn't it? That if we spend all day in in-depth thought, we'd actually use a lot of energy, and our body is designed to actually conserve energy to go into that sort of partial shut-off mode where we do things automatically.
Well, that's quite right. You know, there's a lot of research that's been done on what's called executive function and higher cognitive processing and also self-control. And when we're at work, we have normally great demands on our executive function. We have to exert self-control, we have to behave in a professional way, ignore distractions, overcome the resistance to do tasks that we don't want to do, and all that kind of thing. And self-control is a limited resource, and when you use it, you use it up. And I'm sure many of the our viewers today will have experienced, had the experience when they drive home from work and they pull up in their driveway in their car and they can't remember anything at all about the journey.
Yes.
Why not? Because you just reverted to system one because, as you say, system two is effortful and it can be depleted. Those resources can be depleted.
Yes. We've got some great questions coming in. So hello to everyone watching. Hi, Mal. Let's say hello to our viewers. So we've got Tim. Tim said, Bob, from your intro, it appears you think in terms of performance influencing factors. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, it's a fair characterization of how I think about human error. And the other thing I would say about human error that's, I think, that needs to be said is that people make errors all the time, but normally nothing happens.
Yes.
It goes back to what I was saying earlier about human factors. It's not about people. It's about the rest of the system and how it all fits together. Because people make errors all the time, normally nothing happens for several reasons. Firstly, because we are able to detect that we've made an error and we can correct it, or because it was inconsequential. When we're looking at industrial safety and occupational safety, if an error is inconsequential or not, now that's where the interesting questions really start.
Yes.
Why was it inconsequential? Maybe it was inconsequential because of the way the system was designed, because the designers had put in additional safety features because they had anticipated these errors might occur. I don't want to go too far down that path because that's all part of human factors, but again, it just illustrates some of the points that we've been making so far. So yes, in terms of thinking about human error, yeah, I do think about performance shaping factors, but in terms of human factors and ergonomics generally, it's a design discipline, and I think about lots of other things as well, like biomechanics, for example, and back injury.
We've got another question from Janet. She said, could you please tell us about your The Mind at Work concept, intention, action, interpretation?
I'd love to, but I've forgotten what I said about it.
It's quite a big area. I think that's like chapter 12.
I wrote a lot about that, but in the book, I just wanted to get across some concepts of cognitive psychology, which I think are very useful.
And I think because part of that chapter was around how we have a long-term, short-term memory. And what I've applied from that in my own workplace is that I work in the oil and gas environment. And I've realized that often we expect operators to remember so many things. We expect them to learn off by heart all these different flow rates, and we expect them to know the sequence of steps, and yes, they can take procedures with them whilst doing the task, but actually they'll be carrying equipment. It's not quite that straightforward. And actually, if you have an understanding that our memories do have a limit, and I think that helps us in looking at the tasks, how we've set it up, and to identify are there areas where we can have prompts at the job site. That's something that I've worked on around that topic.
Well, you see them all the time, don't you? I mean, I can remember going around engine rooms in ships where there's lots of pressure gauges, and the engineers down there have actually made little overlays, green and red plastic, and stuck them onto the dials.
Yeah.
This is what Norman called, you know, knowledge in the head versus knowledge in the world.
Yeah.
And when we're designing systems, we really need to think about the requirements for information interchange between operators and systems, taking those memory limitations into account and understanding them. It is quite interesting to see when you actually go into real workplaces and you can actually see what people do to make these systems and make these control rooms more usable. I mean, one of my favourites was from the old report. And if any, I would really recommend it to all of our viewers tonight. If you've never seen the or read any of the report into the Three Mile Island nuclear power station near Meltdown, definitely have a look at it, because there's some wonderful stuff in there. And one of my favourites, which alludes to what we were just been talking about, you know, like memory in the workplace, was how in the control room, it had, you know, it was very much an old knobs and dials and levers kind of control room. They had lots and lots of levers, and they all looked the same. And in order to distinguish them and to communicate with each other when they were talking across the room, the control room operators had actually put the tops of the ear key, you know, those thingies, the taps.
Onto them.
So, you know, it would be like sort of give me 10 seconds of Budweiser, please. So that's the kinds of informal ways that people code the environment around them to overcome those limitations of memory.
Yeah, definitely. Like when you actually go in the field and look at how work is actually happening versus how we imagine it's happening, there's often you spot these workarounds or these aids which the actual staff have created off their own back to assist them in the task. And I think those things need to be spotted more often. And often when I've gone out as part of looking into procedure development, we've actually helped make better job aids based on the designs they came up with, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
Which can further help them. And it's not like telling people off for deviating from the procedure, but in a positive way, if you get what I mean. Sure. We've got another question. It says, hi, Bob. How is ergonomics study helping to improve productivity and morale of employees? Can you explain in a case study example?
I can, but this isn't a sales pitch. It isn't, but as you know, Natalie, every chapter of my book ends with a case study.
Yeah.
So I don't think we should just reiterate, you know, what is already available out there anyway.
Yeah.
I would say that there are loads of those case studies in a variety of different industries, in the automobile industry, in oil and gas, in offices, in loads of different areas. Where ergonomic interventions have been shown to be cost beneficial. There are lots of them out there.
Thank you. George has got a question. George is one of our stream team members. And we said, how about the aspects that a human has from genetics and the learning process at home that they bring with them when they come to work?
I'm not sure about what the reference to genetics. I don't understand.
I think maybe he's talking about how does people's upbringing or perhaps like culture and their genetics affect their behavior or approach to work? Is that another human factor that can be an influence to their performance or approach to work?
Well, I think it can in some industries. Certainly culture does. I mean, I have some views about culture which might may be a bit different from mainstream human factors people, because when I was at university about a million years ago, I studied, I did a year of social anthropology. So I studied culture in different societies all over the world. What I would say to you about culture is this. I like the concept that there are cultural universals. There are like universal cultural concepts that all human societies have. And they have to do things with things like kinship, status, marriage, the significance or the symbolic significance of things like giving gifts and so on. But how they're expressed differs according to different cultures and societies. And years ago, now when I was at school, for example, we sat in our desks, and when the teacher came into the room, we all had to stand up. But when I was working out in Africa many years ago, if you walked into a room and workers were seated on the floor, they wouldn't stand up. why not? It's because, it's not because they were rude. It's because standing up when an authority figure walks into a room has a different meaning there. It's not a meaning of respect. It doesn't mean respect. It's challenging.
Oh, yes.
That's why they stay on the floor.
Mm.
Yeah, it's the same way why kings always used to sit on thrones above their subjects. So culture is a very interesting topic. The one thing that I have come across, which I think is one of the motivations for some of the ideas in crew resource management, are that particularly when you have like multicultural crews on ships, those cultural differences can affect communication. And for example, a junior officer in one culture may simply feel very, very uncomfortable about challenging a senior officer, even though the senior officer is wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas someone from another kind of culture, more perhaps that has that represents status in or perceives status in different ways, wouldn't be so reluctant to challenge a senior officer. So it's not really my field, but I have come across it from time to time. And I do think that when you have multicultural groups of people working together, it's probably something that needs to be considered carefully.
Yes. We've got another question now from Rick. Hello, Rick. So, Dr. Bob, how would you describe the impact of what we as people bring to work, such as their own issues, as a human factors consideration? So perhaps if people have got issues going on at home, how will that affect them as they come to work?
Well, I think that's a very important question. And I came across an example of this in the investigation of a safety occurrence in healthcare that I was supporting a while back. I think the underlying issue here is has a name, and it's called presenteeism. It's where people turn up to work when they're actually not in a fit state to do so, either because of physical health problems or because of mental health problems. Or because of events that are happening in their lives that are causing discomfort and are affecting the operation of system two.
Yeah.
Let's keep our terminology consistent here. That's what a lot of these things do. They mess up system two. It can be very important, and it is, I think, strongly a real management issue. Rather than being a mainstream human factors issue, it's something that we have. In the case I was involved with a while back, the behavior of one of the doctors was very difficult to understand. I mean, the behavior at around the time the safety occurrence occurred. looking into it, we found that in that particular case, in the last previous month, apart from having to work very long hours, two of the doctor's friends from medical school had committed suicide.
Oh, yeah. So that would understandably affect how he approached work. Yes,
it would, and it also illustrates the issue of presenteeism. Now, I didn't have time to ask to look in. We didn't have time to look into this in any more detail. But there are interesting questions you can ask there. Did anybody in the management in the line management team know that this had happened? If they did know, had they taken all reasonable steps to ensure that the person was fit to work?
Yeah.
I don't know, because we didn't have time to delve into any of those matters. Because I think it was probably outside the scope anyway, but I mentioned it just because it is an example of how, for the question of how personal issues can affect what goes on in the workplace. It is important. It's not a mainstream human factors issue in the sense that if you look at the Journal Ergonomics, the Journal of Human Factors, you won't find many articles on it. You might find a few if you dig deeply enough. So it's not an area where I have any particular expertise. It's certainly something that I know is important, and particularly in when you're working on things like one of the things that I do nowadays, which is investigating safety practices.
Yeah.
So certainly that is important.
I guess it shows the importance of knowing your team and spotting when they're not behaving themselves and identifying that early and approaching them about it before you have an incident, you know, especially in high risk environments like medical care environments and high risk environments like oil and gas situations, like offshore workers, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, speaking as an ex-line manager myself, I was a line manager. I had a department of 5-6 staff for 19 years. So I've had quite a lot of experience of managing people. And one thing I can tell you about this is that, yeah, you do have to, when you're a manager, you have both a responsibility to your employees and you have to have also respect their privacy. So you're actually treading a fairly thin line all the time. But it does help. Yeah. If you have a management system in place, that's something the organization puts in place, that gives you some scope to operate when there are problems.
Yeah.
So I think that is an area it's relevant, but it moves more into sort of the general management occupational psychology area.
Thank you. So we've got another question. There's so many questions coming in, so I don't want us to miss answering people's questions as they've taken time to post them. So I'm not sure the person's name. It says, "Hi, Bob, how do you overcome the views that many companies feel that people are the problem and that they should pay more attention? For example, to do mindfulness training, to have more systems to thinking. Feels like we have a dilemma, between designing for people while calling out their frailties."
Well, I didn't know that many companies did feel that most people were the problem. And I think it probably displays on the part of the company a failure to consider that it might be that the way they manage people are the problem. And I think the question has made introduced a good point is that I think companies are often they get lured into buying short training courses for people, don't they? Like sort of by these sort of snake oil salesmen, you know, that will give your employees a day off, and we'll all go a sort of like paintball shooting. Yeah. Or we'll have a team building exercise doing something, which really isn't the point. And again, I was speaking a manager. If you want to get the best out of people, you've got to find out what they want from work, what they're getting from it, and what options they think they have. So if they're just there for the money, then really it doesn't say much about you as a manager. I haven't got my human factors hat on anymore. I've got my ex head of department's hat on.
Yeah,
you know, to see people as the problem, I think just shows that it's the management that's the problem.
Yeah,
I think I better get off my soapbox.
That was from Diane Chadwick Jones. So, oh, hi, Diane.
Please don't follow that question up with any of my ex members of staff.
We've got a question from Tim. In your experience, to what extent do you see leaders as having a good understanding of their influence at an organisational level upon operational or safety performance?
Well, I suppose, do you mean leaders as individuals or leaders or managers in general? I think that there's so much variability. I've worked in very well managed organizations and very badly managed organizations. I think there's so much, I don't think one can generalize in that way. I think that there is so much variability that it's impossible to say.
Yeah.
Or impossible for me to say, certainly based on my own experience.
Yeah.
I do know what good management looks like and what bad management looks like because I've had personal experience of both.
Yes. I'm sure quite a lot of our viewers probably have experienced that as well. We've got Mal's question here. Bob, you agree that we are moving more and more towards autonomy or perhaps it's, do you agree that we're moving more and more towards automation? How do you maintain situational awareness with full autonomy?
Well, the answer is you have to design a task that requires situation awareness. I'm going to leave it there, because if you design a system that does anything, what is the operator's job?
Yeah.
We all know, remember Lizanne Bainbridge, you know, the ironies of automation, which I won't go into now because it's very well known and very insightful at the time. It's been around for 40 years. But you maintain situation awareness by giving someone a meaningful job to do that fits in what they want from work, what they get from it, and what expectations they think they have, and provides good feedback and all the other things that we talk about in human factors.
And also, if you make everything automatic, then people are losing their competency in operating that equipment. So if it goes down, you will have a full shutdown.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the ironies of automation, yes.
Yeah. We've got another question from George. Jorge, sorry. In your perspective, how design in industrial plants and systems are impacted now with ergonomics issues? This is because in many facilities, many modifications need to apply during operations because ergonomics are not considered, especially for maintenance activities.
Well, I don't know how the design of industrial plants and systems, how well it is impacted by ergonomics generally. I can tell you that the literature on industrial ergonomics is so extensive and so well established over so many years that it's almost impossible to imagine how any organisation or industrial plant can get things wrong nowadays.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, years ago, overseas, I used to do consulting in industrial ergonomics. And normally the plants where there was a very poor and inefficient and also dangerous design typically was a failure of management. And it wasn't just a failure of management. It was a failure to employ the right skills at managerial level. I remember going into an ice cream factory once, and all the managers were trained in either accountancy or food technology.
Yeah.
There wasn't an engineer in there.
No.
But they didn't have an industrial engineer. You know, so again, when you look at badly designed industrial plants, the first thing I'd want to know more about would be the managers, who they are and what their qualifications are. Oh, there's another one there.
We've got so many questions tonight. Janet, so are there any tools or systems that help us to manage human factors, e.g. risk assessments?
Yeah, there's loads of them.
From Jeanette.
Depends what part of the world. If you're in the States, there's the NIOSH lifting equation. There's the strain index. If you're in the UK, there's all that wonderful stuff that the Health and Safety Executive produces. You know, on manual handling and repetitive work and all that kind of thing. If you're in Australia, there's WorkSafe Australia, or I don't know whether they're still around. I'm sure they are. They do a wonderful job producing some wonderful stuff on health and safety and risk assessment. So, yeah, there's loads of it. Loads of it. And from what I know, last time I looked, a lot of it had been shown to be, you know, these are like the gold standard key performance indicators for risk assessment tools. Valid, reliable, adds value. Valid, reliable, has diagnostic value, and gives you a clear recommendations for improvement. Bang, there you go.
We might have to link some links, I think, at the end of the call to different resources that people have asked you about, probably.
Well, of course, I've summarised all of this in my book, you know.
Yes, or they can just buy your book.
I don't want to keep plugging it.
Yes. Yeah. We've got Nilesh. I hope I'm saying everyone's names right tonight. Is there any artificial intelligence exercise done to identify hazards for human factors while studying ergonomic analysis?
Not as far as I know. The only areas where I've just reviewed a paper for a journal called Artificial Intelligence in Medicine, which is about an expert system for diagnosing back problems. But that's the closest I've got to it, really. So I'm a bit stumped with that one, actually.
Yeah. And we've got a question from Rick. So, as a follow-up to Tim's last question, in your experience, are senior leaders sufficiently knowledgeable on the human factors elements of their business?
I think it depends on the organisation. Having worked for the Royal Navy in this country, I would say, yeah, they are. They're pretty good. I'm impressed. Also in, I think, and in the States too, in defence procurement, they are pretty good. And in some of the Scandinavian countries and France as well, yeah. I think when you get out, I think most of the high-risk industries, it's been around for quite a while and it's coming on. I think it's making its way in healthcare too. It's all really quite positive. I don't really know who the laggards are, you know, the people who are falling behind, because they don't employ me, obviously. You know.
Yeah.
So I can't really comment on them. I tend to interact with the companies and the kind of sectors where... yeah, where they do take it seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the last year, as part of my job hunt, I've moved into a new position now, but I did meet with some companies where they'd basically got their safety performance to a good level, but now they're looking to take it up to the excellent level. And so it was quite encouraging to see some organisations starting a journey in building capability in their staff around understanding human factors and looking into their processes from a human factors perspective. So it was interesting to see roles coming up that were combining safety and human factors at sort of operational levels. And these were sort of less high risk organizations. So, but what do you think about if organizations are currently at that good level of safety performance where they feel they've reduce sort of larger incidents and they've increased reporting of near misses and hazards, but they're looking to take it to the next level to achieve excellence in their organization. How do you feel that human factors can benefit them in that sort of strategy?
Well, it will help them move from basing their safety assessments on lagging indicators, such as the ones that you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
Start looking at leading indicators, one of which would be identifying their staff occupying the new roles which you referred to, and getting them on one of the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics learning pathways to technical membership.
Yeah.
That's a plug for the Institute, but no,
yeah.
The Institute's producing these pathways and it's great.
Yeah.
And so you can be someone from in a safety role or an occupational health role in an organization, one of the sectors, they will improve their capability and move up to the next level, get to one of the institutes' learning pathways and become a technical member.
Yes, I followed that pathway myself, so yeah, I can definitely recommend it. building capability.
Because as you know, one of the leading indicators is, of course, staff training and development in safety.
Yes. Thank you. So we've got Tim who says, to what extent do you believe the likes of engineering and academic institutions appreciate the benefits of incorporating human factors into technical and engineering design degrees?
Well, there's a very important point to make here, which some people don't understand. a lot of main, particularly in the UK, because we don't have a strong history, as far as I know, of industrial engineering degrees. Or if we do, we didn't really call it that. Whereas in the States, in other countries, you can go to university and study industrial engineering. And I know that for many, many years, ergonomics factors in the States have been integrated into those degrees for many, many years. And now, I know that for certain reasons, because I know where my books sell. Sorry to keep plugging it, but it's true. But there has been some discussion recently about other engineering degrees and probably incorporating other elements of ergonomics and human factors. And I would imagine that the main challenge there is to justify more teaching time in a crowded in an already crowded curriculum.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem, because the days when, you know, we could just knock on people's doors and they'd let us in, I think are long gone, because there are so many new developments and new areas and new things that people have to be trained in engineering I think there's not easy to make the case for human factors in an already crowded curriculum.
Yeah.
Particularly if it means the university's got to employ new staff.
Yeah.
Which of course has financial implications.
We've got another question from Jorge. If you see the root cause analysis for accidents, a high number of them have a human factors cause, many of them for training issues, but now production is fighting with free time for training. So what do you think about this?
Well, one of the points that I always make is that not all accidents have a root cause. I think that training is an issue sometimes, but going back, if you think about it, there's something called socio-technical systems theory, which is has been very influential for the last 70 years. And one of the principles of that is that variance in a system should be controlled as close as possible to its source. What that means in effect is that where you have something that looks like a root cause, there is no point, or it's not very satisfactory, to try to control it by training people to deal with it. Get the design right in the first place. That's it.
Yeah.
I often find in my research that a lot of the problems are not to do with training or skills or people at all. It's not the people doing the stuff on the wards or on the factory floor who are the problem. It's the people who write the policies.
Yeah. I think that's so fascinating what you said, that not everything has a root cause, because as someone who's like been involved with incident investigations, you often feel quite pressured that you have to come up with the answer, like what was the main cause and now what are we going to do about it? And actually, I don't think I've ever heard somebody say that before, that actually sometimes there isn't a root cause. I don't know about any of our viewers if they've actually heard that or understood or sort of been told that within their organisation.
Well, sometimes there isn't a root cause. There are just different performance factors. Sometimes there is a root cause, sometimes there isn't. That's the whole point, I suppose, of doing a human factors analysis. You know, we do have to be very careful in human factors, because there are different approaches towards looking at accidents and the causes of them, or identifying the performance shaping factors. And then there are models as well. But one of the problems is and this is something that I explain about in my new book, is that when you're investigating accidents, it's like trying to solve what's called an indeterminate problem in mathematics or statics. In other words, there are more unknowns than knowns. So if you imagine you've got the equation that will tell you the compression on the lumbar intervertebral disc when the person lifts up the badly designed load, the badly designed job. But the problem is, we don't know all the forces and all the different muscles, what role the ligaments play or anything. So you can't actually solve it. So you have to make some assumptions about how the system works. Like, oh, well, it actually works to minimize the maximum stress in any particular muscle or ligament, blah, 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 blah. And then you can go off and do some optimization modeling or something clever mathematical and solve it. And a lot of what are called models of safety, like this sort of cheese model and that, they're like that. They kind of acknowledge the fact that we never know everything about what really happened or how it all works really. But here's a way of thinking about it. So like with the Swiss cheese model, you know, like holes in barriers, of course, that leads you into the trap of barrier thinking. But they're all good. But they all have traps. Now, Sonny is now asking me to tell you a new book. And that's a very appropriate point to ask me, in fact, when we're talking about safety and accidents. In the new book, it's called Introduction to Human Factors in Accident Investigation. And it's got 15 chapters. It's built around a competency framework. It's not the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics competency framework. It's not the International Ergonomic Association's competency framework. And it's not the Human Factors and Ergonomic Society's competency framework. However, it'll be made to map onto all of those frameworks, because really we're all singing off the same, so to speak. So it's built around a competency framework. It gives you the basic understanding of all of the different competencies of human factors and how they apply to accident investigation. It's got lots of examples of them. Every one of them is, if you like, contextualized with a real accident, something that actually happened. It also has an audit tool in it, fairly simple audit tool, to help you to assess or audit how well human factors is integrated into your own organization.
Oh, that's great.
So, and it also has lots of nasty things to say about people who like making models but don't validate them. We won't go there, because that's just me being me. But anyway, in general, it's written, it's easy to understand. I've tried to write it so that it is relatively easy to understand by people who speak English as a second language.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
But that's a bit difficult to do. But let's just say a graduate who speaks English as a second language.
Yeah.
Or an undergraduate who speaks English as a second language should find it fairly easy going. For example, there's no talk at all about complex socio-technical systems.
Yeah.
That word is banned from the whole book. The word complexity is banned from the whole book, because really, in the real world, even if things are complex, we don't have time to deal with that complexity anyway. We've got managers who want us to produce results.
Yeah.
And we've got to get started. It is only a start. It's only a foundation level as well. But so hopefully it's something that people who know nothing about human factors, you might be or health and safety officer, you might be a safety engineer, you might be an occupational psychologist, and you might see this, well, maybe this is an area that I could develop my career in. It's like the book for you. It will just get you started on the first rung of that ladder, and then you can decide from there whether you want to progress or not.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So when is that available, Bob?
Hopefully by September.
Yeah, and
be available on Amazon.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure we can share about it on Redriss on our LinkedIn page when it's available.
But you can find any of my stuff. Just type my name, you know, Amazon.
Yeah,
or go to my website and you can find details of all the books.
Yeah. Sunny said, is the focus of your new book on soft, hard skills or both?
The focus of the new book is on learning rather than skills. It's about probably, but it's on the soft side. There's no equations.
Yeah.
You don't have to do any calculations. you don't have to learn much or really any complicated technical terminology like decibels or newtons or anything like that. So there's no programming or anything like that. It's all fairly sort of easy to understand. I think it would probably be the kind of thing you would go for also in a university as an undergraduate text first year.
Yeah.
But also you don't need a degree to understand it either. You know, any intelligent layman should be able to understand it, learn from it. Yeah. It also contains lots and lots of examples of the kind of questions that you should ask, or you could ask, or might want to ask when investigating an accident. Just kind of prompt you forward. And it gives you some next steps with further reading. And I recommend other people's books too as further reading. And papers, and also some of the publications of the Chartered of Ergonomics and Human Factors,
yeah.
Which is producing some excellent stuff. Safety error. So that's basically what the new book's about. It's like the first rung in the ladder who almost a sort of test the water, if you don't mind me mixing my metaphors.
I saw on LinkedIn a little while ago that you did a personal training qualification.
Yeah.
I wondered how you found that. Would you recommend it to other human factors practitioners or health and safety practitioners?
That's a difficult one. I would only recommend doing a personal training qualification if you actually like doing personal training and like keeping fit, but not to get a piece of paper.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons I did it is because, you know, I've been going to gym and working out on and off for 40 years, so it's part of my life.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's personal training and I'm working out and it's system one. It's not system two. You know, there's no overcoming inner resistance for me to go to a gym.
Yeah.
And have an exercise. It's like brushing your teeth, you know, you just do it.
Yeah.
So if you like personal training and fitness, then definitely I would recommend doing some kind of course. I want to do another one, actually. I want to do a more advanced one now because I'd like to do a bit more instructing. But I think for me, apart from my own personal benefits from it, I find that it helps me to write about some of the things that I want to write, because as you know, I'm also interested in like working from home, hybrid working,
and
new active working in the office, which is my other book, you know, Guide to Active Working in the Modern Office.
Yes.
Why sitting isn't the new smoking and all that, but how you need to be more active at home. So that gives me the opportunity to, the qualification gives me the opportunity to say, speak more from a more authoritative stance about some of the things that people should be doing to keep fit. Because, you know, ergonomics is a bit negative in that sense, in that it's sort of about, certainly the physical ergonomics, about stopping bad things from happening to people. The personal training qualification gives me more confidence in being able to advise people on what they can do to actually improve their situation, improve their fitness and health.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We're running out of time and I still had so many questions. We'll have to get you back another time. I think everyone's thoroughly enjoyed our conversation tonight, and we just want to say thank you so much, Bob, for giving up your evening to share with us. We've definitely learned so much, and we'll be looking up your new book as it comes out and your other books as well. So thank you so much. Is there anything you would like to say before we go off?
Well, no, thanks, Natalie, and thanks everyone. Thanks everyone for listening, and I enjoyed some of your questions. I hope I was able to answer them reasonably coherently, but sometimes it's not always possible with all the pressure like this and you're doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but no, it was great fun. I enjoyed talking, and I hope you found it useful.
Yeah. It's been great. Thank you so much. Yeah. So we'll catch you all soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Good night.
Thank you so much for stopping by and watching that live event. If you want to be notified of future live events, head over to our website. There's a form on there, hit the subscribe button, and I'll update you whenever live events come up. I promise you, no spam. And finally, we do have a YouTube channel. It's just simply Red Risks. Please subscribe and help us. Let's connect, share, and learn. Thanks.